Welcome to Earth Matters, environmental justice stories from so-called Australia and around the world. Produced at the studios of 3CR on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country in Naam, Melbourne, and broadcast across the continent via the Community Radio Network. I pay my respects to elders past and present of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung, and of the many lands our content reaches. I recognise that sovereignty has never been ceded. This always was and always will be Wurundjeri Woiwurrung land. And I affirm that there can be no environmental justice without justice for First Nations peoples across the globe. I'm Mia Audrey.
So what Clive Palmer is doing, he's using ISDS to bypass Australian court decisions and to challenge democratically decided climate policies. And these join a growing global list of ISDS claims.
Six weeks ago, billionaire businessman Clive Palmer lost a $300 billion case against the Australian government when the High Court determined that he is not, in fact, a Singaporean investor. It may sound absurd, but Palmer's case had potential, and he has three more similar cases in the works. Across the globe, fossil fuel companies are taking up a secret weapon against climate action. It's baked into many trade agreements and allows corporations to bypass court systems and sabotage climate policies. The culprit? Something called investor-state dispute settlements, or ISDS. These strange mechanisms have the potential to crush what little progress states are making on climate action. Here in Australia, Labor has introduced policies against them, but the shift is slow and costs are stacking up. To fill us in on this toxic global loophole, I called on the Australian Fair Trade and Investment Network, AFTINET. Audio for this episode comes from their recent webinar on ISDS and features expert voices on the problem and its solutions. Later in the show, we'll hear from Dr. Pat Ranald, convener at AFTINET, about the Clive Palmer case outcome and what's next. We'll also get a breakdown of the threat ISDS poses to climate action from the Australian Conservation Foundation's former parliamentary and political relations manager, Maria Poulos Conklin. But first, here's Kyla Tianara. She is Canada Research Chair in Economy and Environment and Associate Professor in the School of Environmental Studies and Department of Global Development Studies at Queen's University, Kingston. She explains what ISDS is and why it poses a major threat to climate action.
So I am not going to assume prior knowledge of investment treaties in the audience. So I'm just going to start with the basics of what they are and why they matter in this discussion. First thing to note is that there are a lot of investment treaties, more than 2,500 currently in force. So the key mechanism in these treaties that makes them so powerful and so dangerous is that they provide a specific group of private actors, foreign investors, with direct access to a system of international arbitration without first having to exhaust local remedies. In other words, foreign investors can bypass local courts completely if they have a dispute with a government and go directly to this process of ISDS, investor state dispute settlement. Through this process, investors can bring claims for monetary compensation if a government implements policies that has a negative impact on their investment. And then a panel of three individuals called arbitrators will decide whether the government has breached one or more of the vague provisions that are found in these treaties. And if they decide that there has been a breach of a treaty, they can award monetary damages to the investor. So there are a lot of problems that have been identified with this whole process. They're sometimes referred to as courts, but they don't operate the same way as courts. First of all, there's serious conflicts of interest that can arise because individuals can act as an arbitrator in one case and then act as a lawyer on behalf of an investor in another case. This is something that would never be allowed in a domestic court system. You can't have lawyers acting as judges in some cases. There are also issues with a lack of transparency in the process. Proceedings in most cases are not open to the public, and documents are not always published. There are also very limited opportunities for third parties, such as environmental organizations, local communities, to intervene in and participate in the proceedings in any way. And then there are the costs of the proceedings, which can drag on for many years, and these can be pretty astounding. So I think the most recent data was that it's around 5 million US is the average cost for states, but we know there are cases where governments have spent in the range of 20 to 40 million dollars just on defending themselves. Another issue is that if an award is made against the state, there's very limited options to challenge it. There is no appellate process, as there is, for example, in the World Trade regime. And as a result of this, there can be a lot of inconsistency in how these ad hoc tribunals interpret these very vague treaties. That makes it difficult for governments faced with a dispute to know whether or not they're likely to be successful in their defense. So I don't really have a lot of time to delve into the sort of legal jargon and content of the investment treaties, but I'll give a brief overview. Most investment treaties include the following standards of treatment and protection for investors: national treatment, most favored nation treatment, fair and equitable treatment, and protection from expropriation without compensation. I just want to highlight fair and equitable treatment as being the provision that is most likely to be invoked by an investor in a claim, also the most difficult to pin down. One of the most problematic aspects is the interpretation that is very popular among these arbitral tribunals that states need to meet the quote-unquote legitimate expectations of investors. That means that an investor can argue that if it didn't think that a policy was going to change over time, then it should be insulated from the impacts of that change. Obviously, you can see how that would be relevant in the climate policy sphere, where we have constant changing knowledge updates in terms of science and changing approaches in terms to how we tackle the problem. The bottom line here is that the provisions are very vague, open to interpretation, and that gives a great deal of power to these tribunals, and it creates a lot of uncertainty for governments. And that uncertainty is particularly dangerous because the system can result in really significant amounts of public funds being paid out to these private investors. The average award in the decade between 1994 and 2003 was only 25 million US, and that has increased tenfold to an average of 256 million in the decade between 2014 and 2023. Tribunals have awarded sums exceeding 100 million in more than a quarter of all ISDS cases that have been won by investors. And the reason why these awards are so large is that tribunals are increasingly awarding investors not just what they had actually spent on a project up until the date of the dispute, but also the potential profits that they might have made if the project has proceeded as they had planned. And tribunals are doing this even in cases where the project was at the very initial stages of planning or development and may not even have had all of the necessary permits, like environmental impact assessment permits and things like that. When it comes to large awards, there's one sector in particular that has been doing very well in ISDS, and this is the fossil fuel industry. So, fossil fuel investors are big users of the ISDS system. One out of every five cases is related to a fossil fuel project, and there have been at least 350 cases so far, and many of them are recent and still pending conclusion. Fossil fuel investors have also been big winners in the system. If a case makes it past the jurisdiction stage, then they have a 75% chance of winning, which is actually much higher than the average across all other sectors. And they've won a lot of compensation so far, at least $82.8 billion in damages. And that, I should note, is money that can then be reinvested in more fossil fuel projects, further exacerbating the climate crisis. So that's all the bad news. There is some good news, which is what I'll end on. The good news is that governments are increasingly waking up to the fact that the system is terrible and needs to be either substantially reformed or, my preference, abolished. The problem is there's more than 2,500 treaties out there, and the efforts are very fragmented. And this is why we need a country to come forward, I think, really to try to lead an effort to bring like-minded countries together in some kind of arrangement to get rid of as many treaties as possible at once.
Kyla Tianara of Queen's University Kingston on the need for a global leader against investor-state dispute settlements so we don't lose crucial ground in the fight for climate action. You're listening to Earth Matters, Community Radio's national environmental justice program. We're hearing about a little-known legal mechanism with major consequences, investor-state dispute settlement. Because of ISDS, we're seeing governments dial back climate ambition, drop environmental safeguards, and fall short of international obligations. For an organiser's perspective on ISDS and its impacts, here's Maria Poulos-Conklin, the former Parliamentary and Political Relations Manager at the Australian Conservation Foundation.
I'm going to bring an environmental campaigner's perspective on ISDS. And what I would like to do is to cover three areas today, where Australia is heading on climate and industry policy, why investor-state dispute settlement cuts across that, and what practical fixes might look like. So where we are heading, Australia's climate goals are clear, as you all know. We have a 43% emissions reduction target by 2030, net zero by 2050, and we've just announced our 2035 target to reduce emissions in the range of 62 to 70%. And this is backed up by policies like the Safeguard Mechanism to lower industrial emissions. And of course, we at the same time have the Future Made in Australia agenda, which aims to make us a renewable energy superpower, building clean manufacturing, adding value to critical minerals, and creating regional jobs. Now, to actually deliver on this, the government needs room to move. We need to phase down coal and gas. We need to tighten pollution rules, and especially methane, and steer investment into transmission and clean industry. Now, the simple truth is that the stronger our climate policy is and becomes, the more ISDS risk bites. And every dollar tied up in defending an investor state dispute settlement claim is a dollar not going into building transmission lines or not supporting workers in the transition or not restoring bushland that stores carbon. So basically, the cases run in private tribunals, there is no precedent, there is no appeal, their legal costs are high, and awards are huge. And we've seen examples where fossil fuel companies have used it to push back on coal phase outs, offshore drilling limits, and permit refusals. And the biggest impact is not just the payouts, it is the policy chill. And ministers slow down, water down action because of the legal risk. And we've seen that in many cases already. Few examples where we can see policy chill in practice. New Zealand joined the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance only as an associate member, not as a full member, because they were worried about, they expressed concerns about investor lawsuits if they committed to ending new oil and gas permits. And this is a government openly dialing back ambition due to the risk of investor state dispute settlement. We've seen many cases in Germany, like Germany's coal exit saw compensation for a lignite operator rise sharply, and officials acknowledge that avoiding a possible lawsuit under the Energy Charter Treaty influenced the higher payout. In other words, paying more to avoid being sued. And we saw Vattenfall, the case where a Swedish energy firm launched a $1.9 billion investor state claim against Germany over permit delays for a coal-fired power plant. And that ended with a settlement that required the city to drop extra environmental safeguards. So I want to just quickly go through some of Australia's specific exposure. Now, Australia has a sizable investor state dispute settlement footprint, around 25 agreements in force that include this provision. Roughly 15 are standalone bilateral investment treaties, about 10 are free trade agreements that include ISDS. And then we have the big plurilateral agreements, including the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, the ASEAN Australia New Zealand Free Trade Agreement. Japan's agreement doesn't have an ISDS, but there is a review clause to include it in the future. But the China and Korea ones do, and that is important for a reason. It matters because Korea, China, Japan, India, and other countries have major stakes in our fossil fuel assets. Now, we've got Japanese companies like Mitsui & Co., Mitsubishi Corporation, that hold interest in projects such as the Northwest Shelf, Wheatstone and Browse. We have Korean Gas Corporation that holds a significant stake in Gladstone Liquefied Natural Gas in Queensland. And we have the China National Offshore Oil Corporation that holds interest in Queensland, Curtis Liquefied Natural Gas in the Northwest Shelf, and many other examples and many investments in the pipeline. Now, picture this likely scenario. Australia declines a future coal or gas project, or tightens methane standards, or tightens the screws on the safeguard mechanism. A Korean or Chinese registered investor could bring an ISDS claim under those treaties for alleged losses, even when the decision is about meeting our climate obligations. And yes, even the threat of a claim can slow things down, as we have seen in other jurisdictions. Say, let's look at another example that is highly possible. Say we set a methane rule that cuts leaks by 75%. Great for climate, good for households, but under the Korea-Australia Free Trade Agreement or the China-Australia Free Trade Agreement, a foreign gas investor could still allege indirect expropriation. They might not win, but just the threat alone can stall the rule or the policy for months or years. But where does this become a threat? Well, it effectively creates two classes of investors. Australian firms play by Australian law, but some foreign fuel investors can sue Australia for enforcing that law. And that tilts the field towards yesterday's industries, and it spooks clean economy investors who want stable, durable rules. Clean economy investors are not asking for special courts. They want clear rules that will not vanish. So removing ISDS is pro-certainty. It says the rules are set in parliament, they're set by our politicians, they are not set in private arbitration. And I just wanted to also very quickly focus on a recent international law development. In July 2025, the ICJ issued an advisory opinion that the countries have legal duties to prevent climate harm. And that includes regulating high-emitting activities and, where necessary, revoking or declining licenses. In other words, knocking back coal and gas. It also said investment rules should be read in light of those duties. In plain terms, Australia has a positive obligation to act. ISDS provisions that penalise such action are out of step and misaligned. So the ICJ is clear we have a duty to prevent climate harm. Aligning our treaties with that duty is not radical, it is simply respecting international law. The practical fixes that are simple and doable: neutralise the riskiest exposure, prioritise removing ISDS from all FTAs, and remove special carve-outs for climate and environmental measures that phase down the fossil fuels and methane standards. Keep ISDS out of future deals, be consistent, and lock in a Paris-aligned safeguard, make it a standing rule that no agreement should prevent Australia from meeting its climate and biodiversity obligations, and publish the exposure. Ask DFAT and Treasury to map sector by sector ISDS settlement risk and potential liabilities and treat it as a fiscal risk in future budgets. Investors value transparency. And finally, lead internationally. Work with partners to modernize or retire outdated protections that prop up fossil fuels and set climate consistent investment norms across international forums. To close very quickly, we can deliver 62 to 70% by 2035. It's not that ambitious a target, but we can do that and allow Australia to become a renewable energy superpower if our trade rules do not sabotage our climate rules. Reforming ISDS is basic climate sovereignty and good industrial policy. No country becomes a renewable energy superpower while paying compensation to keep coal and gas alive. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you so much.
Maria Poulos-Conklin of the ACF on the need to protect climate sovereignty by rejecting regressive trade rules and making fossil fuel companies stay in line. You're listening to Earth Matters, Community Radio's National Environmental Justice Program. We're spotlighting investor-state dispute settlements, the mechanism in many trade agreements that means fossil fuel companies can demand payouts when a climate policy hurts their bottom line. Over the last 2 years, we've watched one particularly strange case play out in Australia. After the West Australian government rejected his mining project, Clive Palmer posed as a Singaporean investor to claim compensation. To speak on the case and what's to come, here's Dr. Pat Ranald, Honorary Research Assistant at the University of Sydney and convener at the Australian Fair Trade and Investment Network.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about Clive Palmer's recent iron ore ISDS case decision and his three correlated ISDS cases and where to from here and some of the issues about action that we can take to get our government to do more. So How is Clive Palmer using ISDS? Investor state dispute settlement is really about giving extra legal rights to global corporations that already have enormous market power, and they lack the safeguards of national legal systems. So they're secret, the judges are, there's no independent judges, precedents, or appeals, and there are inconsistent decisions. They're not in all trade and investment agreements, but corporations can change the location of their investments to use ISDS in particular agreements. And this is what Clive Palmer has done. So Australia does have a policy against ISDS at the moment under the Labor government. After years of community campaigning, Labor adopted a policy against ISDS in new agreements and to review it and remove it in existing agreements. And it is doing a review of existing agreements, but it's a slow process. There's 25 agreements with ISDS, and we have 10 that don't have ISDS. Australian billionaire and pro-Trump politician Clive Palmer has taken advantage of ISDS in the ASEAN-Australia-New Zealand Free Trade Agreement and initially also in the Singapore-Australia Free Trade Agreement. But there are now three claims proceeding under the ASEAN-Australia-New Zealand Agreement. So how did he do this? He registered his mining company in Singapore, claiming to be a Singapore investor. Used ISDS in Australian trade agreements with Singapore to claim a total of $420 billion in compensation from the federal government in four separate cases. So the first claim of $300 billion relates to a dispute with the Western Australian government for an iron ore mining license. So it's not about coal. That one isn't about climate change. But he lost this dispute in the High Court. His three other claims of $120 billion are because community campaigning led Queensland courts to deny licenses for a coal mine, a coal-fired power station, and use of offsets for environmental reasons. And the basis for this decision included their contribution to carbon emissions, as well as local environmental impacts. So what Clive Palmer is doing, he's using ISDS to bypass Australian court decisions and to challenge democratically decided climate policies. And these join a growing global list of ISDS claims. So that brings us to the case, which was the decision was recently in the media. It was announced the first case, the really big one for $300 billion. There was a decision announced on September 27th in 2025. Now, the tribunal first considered whether Palmer was a Singaporean investor. That's what the decision was about. And those hearings were held in September 2024. And the tribunal decision was announced a year later this year in September. But the full decision hasn't yet been published. So we have an announcement by our government of what the decision was, but we can't, the tribunal hasn't yet published the full decision. And both the length of time and the lack of publication illustrate the sort of secrecy and difficulties with this whole system. So the decision actually found that Palmer was not a Singaporean investor and ordered him to pay $13.6 million in government legal costs. And both parties, that is the government and Clive Palmer, had previously agreed to suspend hearings on the three coal-related cases pending this decision. But this decision isn't a formal precedent. They'll all be heard separately. Now, what the government hoped was that Palmer would withdraw the three remaining cases if he lost the threshold issue about the Singapore investor in the first case. Palmer's response is that he's going to challenge this decision. And that means it's possible that he'll proceed with the three coal-related claims. So Palmer is challenging the decision by seeking annulment in the Supreme Court of Switzerland, which is what is called one of the seats of the international tribunal process, which can enforce things like payments. Now, this Swiss court is not an appeal mechanism in the broad sense because it can't consider the merits of the decision. It can only consider technical issues like whether the tribunal was properly constituted, or in some cases they make recommendations about particular amounts of compensation and so on. This means that his claim may not succeed because he can't, although he claims that he's appealing the whole thing, this Swiss court can't hear the actual merits of whether he is a Singaporean investor or not. It can only deal with very narrow technical issues. So it means his claim may not succeed, but it does mean that the government has to spend extra time and costs for government. And for those of us who are familiar with Clive Palmer, we know that he's got very deep pockets and is prepared to prolong litigation for a very long time. But the fact that he's challenged this decision indicates that he's not withdrawing and may proceed with the other three coal-related cases. So this means that Australia could face years of litigation and tens of millions in legal costs for each case, even if Palmer loses. So we need to take the opportunity of Palmer's likely continuing with these coal-related cases to campaign for the government to speed up the implementation of its policies. So, what we're asking the government to do is to speed up reviews of existing agreements, and also to identify ISDS as a major barrier to climate change at the next climate conference, COP31 in 2026, and work with other governments for ISDS exit strategies.
Dr. Pat Ranald of AFDINET on seizing the opportunity of the Clive Palmer cases to campaign for swifter action against investor-state dispute settlement. You've been listening to Earth Matters, Community Radio's National Environmental Justice Program. I'm Mia Audrey. We've heard from Kyla Tianara, Canada Research Chair in Economy and Environment, former ACF Parliamentary and Political Relations Manager Maria Poulos-Conklin, and Dr. Pat Ranald of the Australian Fair Trade and Investment Network. The message is clear. Fossil fuel companies are taking up every possible weapon in the fight for their bottom lines, and we need to stay vigilant. I hope, with me, you've gained some understanding of investor-state dispute settlement and why abolishing it swiftly, decisively, and globally is necessary to safeguard climate progress. You'll find links to AFDINET's website, plus more information on our speakers via 3cr.org.au/Earth Matters. Thanks for listening. That's all for now. But tune in next week for more environmental justice stories. Earth Matters would like to thank the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial support and the Community Radio Network for getting the program out to you. Earth Matters is produced in the studios of 3CR, NAM, Melbourne.